In the future, people will still matter in business, but some people will matter a lot more than others. The consulting firm Accenture interviewed 500 executives around the globe and asked this question: what workforce skills are in most demand and will be most needed over the next 2 to 5 years in business? This is how they answered. Business skills, 68% of them said that's the most important thing. 42% said technical skills, 33% said flexibility and adaptability. Here's the surprising thing. Only 18% said self-motivation. 6% said leadership. And 3% said they will need people who are functionally good at what they do. So if you took the bottom three and you added those up, you were a self-motivated, functional leader. That sounds like a pretty good resume. It just won't be valued by business leaders. However, it's the people who can independently think on their feet, work cross-functionally, learn new skills, work to make great business decisions that are customer-focused for both internal and external customers. That will be indispensable to business. Those are the skills in high market demand. And by the way, executives not only said that they expect to need those skills shortly, they also said they expect those skills to be extraordinarily difficult to come by. Which is good news for you if you have the skills, which is the whole reason we're talking about Business Think in the first place. Now, to get business right, there are a lot of great books written predicting the future of business and where it's headed to try to help you get what you need to be in demand, whether that's as a person or a company. And they're helpful. They widen our perspective. There are also a lot of good books that can kind of tell us where we've been. They're historical in nature. That's the view they take, and we can learn from those, definitely. The focus of Business Think is slightly, maybe dramatically different. Business Think is about what to do now, the compressed now. We aren't futurists. We're not historians. For lack of a better term, we're the nowists. Now is where the future is created and changed. Now is where you are, in the present. Our not-so-subtle point here is change the now. You don't lead a business into the past, and you can't lead a business next week or next year. You can lead the business now. You can lead yourself now. And how you lead the now will affect the future and what your legacy or your history will be. But you don't get the advantage of some business time machine to affect it. You only get the moment, the now. And leading the now will demand that you become a new kind of business person. Not to sound too harsh, but in business, you can place your value as a business person somewhere on a scale between, on one end, a pure cost or a return on investment on the other end. If you're only a cost, your cost is way too high. And if you deliver a return as a person, how high is your return? There are libraries and bookstores full of books that say that there will be no more room for the average performer in the future. Not true. There is always room for the average, lots of room, and plenty of company. The question you have to ask for yourself is, what do you want for yourself and your company? The average is there for the taking. Not much required to get there. If we were to go back to our logic box earlier in the audio, think about this. Since your output, your production, so to speak, is driven by your activities, and your activities are driven by your decisions, and your decisions spring from the well of your thinking, the thought to ponder is, how deep is your thinking? How deep is your company's thinking? Is it a well, or is it the average Dixie cup? Because you're going to be put to the test repeatedly, not only to make fact-based decisions, but also to make sense out of all the conflicting priorities, the flat-out confusion that exists in companies, and I promise it will continue. Great business thinkers are the ones who can handle the confusion, a bunch of ambiguity, sort through it all, and still make good decisions. If you get good at business thinking, it's an opportunity to work through the ambiguity and fail intellectually before the costs of actually building a solution get too high. A huge challenge in making the right decisions for all of us has been the long lag time between cause and effect, between the ideas and decisions and choices we make, and then waiting to see the success or failure of those decisions and what they actually produce. And the gap stays far enough apart that you don't know whether what you're doing is even right or not. Half of all decisions succeed, and the other half fail. The mystery is knowing which half is which. Think about it this way. The rules that Dave and I have been laying out here construct a little black box that compresses the time between cause and effect. If you throw a solution into the box, the business think little black box will move off the solution, grind through the evidence, the impact, the ripple effect, and the yellow lights, and then screen out the impurities of bad ideas. And the output of that box moves you closer to a real solution, not an event. Instead of waiting weeks or months or years to see if something actually works, what if you could compress all of that thinking down into a day? What would you learn? And maybe the bigger question is, how would it change your perspective and the way you think about business or making your decisions? When I started my company that I mentioned earlier, each partner fronted about $700 just to get the idea started. No big deal, right? Not much of an investment, not that big of a risk. Had you asked me about my business thinking at the time, I would have told you that I had it straight. However, $700 was just the beginning. Pretty soon, the infusions of cash got bigger and bigger and were needed more frequently. During my 4 years with the company, I hardly even took a salary. When we closed our business down, when you added up my direct and opportunity cost, the amount exceeded $300,000. Not to mention the mental and emotional costs of working day and night to make the business work. Now, had you asked me, before I began, if I was willing to bet over $250,000 on my business thinking and the business thinking of my partners, our answer would have changed. I needed the little black box.
This idea that we're introducing about this little black box, the business think box, can you imagine the impact that could have on the business world? If, in fact, it could help you rigorously think through the problem or the opportunity, and then calculate the cost of starting and sustaining a business or a project, and if it could tell you the ultimate financial gain or loss of the business based on that thinking, that output would cause a whole bunch of decisions to change. It's unlikely that 2,294 entrepreneurs would still sign up to start a new business every day unless they used the little black box. It's also possible that many more would succeed if they would use it in business. That's what Business Think does. It runs ideas through the black box before running them through the big bad bank account, and it bridges the gap between cause and effect, so your decisions of right now deliver a better future. Now, some of the ideas that we've been sharing with you don't only apply to traditional decisions. Sometimes we as people, not just decisions, can get run through the black box. I had one such experience in a place that I didn't expect, and it changed me forever. A few years ago, I had a very important job interview. And there can be a lot of pressure on both sides in an interview. It's almost a microcosm of business, if you will. I mean, look at it from your perspective. As the candidate, you're under pressure to get it right because the impact of succeeding or failing is big, very big. Your performance in the interview could affect your income, your livelihood, or your career path. Even your self-image if you don't feel like you do well. And because it's competitive, kind of like may the best candidate win, you better be on the top of your game and you better be in the zone when you're talking with them. Now let's look at it from the employer's perspective. They're under pressure to get it right. They have to find the right person for the position. And their choice says a lot about their own ability to recognize and attract the right kind of talent. Other people in the company are going to watch closely, and they're anxious to see who it is they're going to be working with. So as a result, employers come to an interview with a traditional expectation that you're going to come in, demonstrate your brilliance, tell them all about yourself and your resume, and prove why you're the best candidate for the position. And by the way, any sign of weakness, and you're out. Talk about pressure, both on you and them to get it right now and no matter what. In my case, all the usual pressure that shows up in an interview was compounded by what they wanted to get out of this critical position. This company had determined that the senior vice president of sales, for which I was interviewing, was poorly performing, and they'd already fired him. And whoever they hired for his position was expected to be the heir apparent to the CEO. The CEO had already announced his retirement. He was leaving in 2 years. And so they wanted to groom a strong leader for a few years just to make sure that there'd be no disruption in the business. They also thought this would increase the board's confidence. So that was what was going on. And I was scheduled to interview with the chairman of the board. If you were interviewing with the chairman of the board, what would you say about yourself? On the drive over to their office, it started to get to me. My palms started to sweat. My anxiety just skyrocketed. My ego meter started to redline. I'm pounding the steering wheel and hyped myself up to a big frenzy with some self-talk. I mean, I was ready to do the firewalk with Tony Robbins. Luckily, while I was waiting in the lobby, I pulled myself together. I know this will sound sick, but I have business think rules just in my DNA. I'd never applied the business think rules in an interview before, but all of a sudden it dawned on me, why not try? Then it started to sink in. The request for a vice president of sales was really a solution. The only thing I didn't know was what the solution would solve, or what opportunities it had helped them achieve as a company. And I had no evidence or impact. So right there, I decided I needed to move off the solution, and I committed to myself to discover and explore the evidence and the impact, to really just apply the business think rules we've been talking about. Now here's the interesting side note. When you're interviewing for a position, you might imagine it's a bit difficult moving off the solution, especially when you are the solution. Now, again, I think I've already indicated this, but based on the outcome, I will never be the same. Here's the dialogue of that interview. The chairman started out by saying something like, "Well, thanks for coming in, Dave. I've looked over your resume and I'm impressed. Tell me a little bit more about yourself." "Okay, I'll tell you everything you want to know. Just so that I can make my comments more relevant, before we dig into the details about me, do you mind if I ask you a few questions?" "I don't mind at all." So here was my first question. "Well, the vice president of sales is a pretty important position in your company. The last person in this position was recently fired. So if you expect me to be successful and solve some of the problems you've been having in sales, it'd be helpful if I knew a little bit more about what happened. So out of curiosity, without getting into any unnecessary details, what were all the issues that had to be dealt with relative to his poor performance?" Well, the chairman brought up three or four that seemed to make pretty good sense. He said there's been a lack of accountability with the sales staff. He felt that the sales manager was out of touch with sales opportunities themselves, and that generally selling ability in the sales organization was weak. So I asked, "Well, are there any others?" And after a brief pause, he added a few more, like turnover in salespeople's been an issue, and sales wasn't working well with production, and they had some unhappy people and bad morale. So then I ask, of these things, which one would you say was most important? Well, I'd say the biggest issue was the fact that the vice president of sales was out of touch with some of the opportunities our salespeople were working on. Now, in my mind, I wanted to find some evidence that would prove the vice president had been out of touch. So here was my question. What were some of the things that you noticed or experienced that let you know he was out of touch with what was going on? Well, for the last year, I've been hearing reports of big sales opportunities, and none of them have come to fruition. And when I asked the vice president of sales where we were with these opportunities, I never seemed to get any clear information. He always seemed to have a whole bunch of things to say, but I never got the feeling out of what he was telling me that he was on top of it. Well, that makes sense. What else was there too much of that let you know he wasn't on top of things? Now, I watched his eyes as he gave me the evidence. It seemed he was getting great value out of our discussion. He described what he'd heard from others in the sales organization and what a few customers had said, and he included some of his other observations and some from the CEO. Most of the evidence that he gave me was what we call soft evidence. So I wanted to dig for some more hard evidence and see what we could find. So here was my comment. Hey, this is really helping me to understand what not to do and clarifying some of the expectations. I really appreciate it. Out of curiosity, when the vice president of sales is not on top of sales opportunities, then what happens? Well, our salespeople that need help don't think that it's available. And some of them are new to our company, and so they don't know all the ins and outs of what we can do. They need help to advance the sale. And if they don't have that, it causes us to lose momentum with the opportunities. And that's pretty hard to get. It's too easy in our business for customers to go somewhere else if we appear to be unenthusiastic and uninterested. And he told me several other things that happened as a result of the vice president not being on top of things. There was more soft evidence. I still needed to see if there was any hard evidence, so I peeled one more layer off. So when you lose momentum and customers become uninterested, what do those things lead to? We're losing too many opportunities. We're not acquiring new customers. It's also causing some turnover with our salespeople because they don't feel like they're being supported. Bam! We hit some hard evidence. And together we identified the impact of sales and the cost of turnover of salespeople. Both of those were hard evidence. And it added up to about $4 to $5 million. That was the size of the problem they were trying to solve. And now that we both knew the evidence and the impact on the pain side, I wanted to explore the gain side. So here's how I shifted. Wow, this has been really helpful. And I appreciate you sharing so much detail. Let's shift gears a bit. Let's say that you were able to find the exact perfect fit, the right person for this position. Just so I don't miss anything, what are all the results you personally will expect him or her to deliver? Again, the chairman made a list, and I had to prompt him to add a few additional things, some things that might have been missing, and he added a few. So then I ask, of all of those things, if this person could only deliver one of them, which one would you say would be the absolute most important? So he picked one of the issues, and my questions now turn to exploring evidence. Here's how I started. So 1 year down the road, what specifically will you be looking for as criteria that will let you know this person totally nailed it? They totally delivered what you needed. He paused, thought about it for a minute, and then started to share his criteria. And I could watch his eyes. I knew he was getting value out of this. And I still wanted more evidence, so I kept asking questions. Well, that seems as if it would be a pretty good indicator. What else? What else would you be looking at to judge whether this person was successful? Let's say that we'd been down the road 6 months, we're looking back on the performance, what would show up? And once I had sufficient evidence, I started to turn to move from soft evidence to get to hard evidence. And here's kind of what I said. This is really making good sense to me. If you get all of those things in your business, Help me understand, what will that allow you to do as a business that you can't do today? He described several things, some of which were hard evidence, some of which was soft. And I converted the soft evidence into hard evidence. And together, we converted the non-financial data into money. Together, we determined that it was roughly a $9 to a $10 million impact in the revenue. So the last step was to slow down for yellow lights. Here was my question. Out of curiosity, what has stopped you from addressing these issues before now? Now, this was interesting. The chairman paused and he said, that's an interesting question. And then again, he paused for what seemed like an eternity. I'm dying. And here's what he said. I think we've been reluctant to give all the authority needed to salespeople because we've been burned in the past. We've given the authority to approve some of those deals to the VP of sales, but he's been too uninvolved. And also, the president has probably been too focused on the operational side of the business and needs to step up the accountability on the VP of sales. In a flash, 45 minutes passed by, and the chairman glanced down at his watch and he smiled. And he said, well, this has been an interesting interview on our company. When do I get to interview you? Well, I looked at him and I said, well, you can ask me any question you want. Now I can tell you more about the parts of my experience that are most relevant to what you need to know as a business now. And I know what you're trying to accomplish, and I can share what parts of my experience directly relate to that. So ask me any question you want. We talked for another half an hour and I left. See, experience on your resume is like chapters in a book. And I knew after the interview of their company what chapters he needed to read and which ones would simply be a waste of time. Do you think the chairman would have allowed me to sit there and ask questions for 45 minutes if I was wasting his time? He had to think before he could answer most of my questions. He hadn't thought in depth about the story behind the pain or the gain or what they were trying to accomplish. And in less than 1 hour, I was able to develop a better understanding of what had happened in the past and what they hoped to have happen in the future. And the impact of the pain and the payoff of the gain they wanted when added together was roughly a $14 to a $15 million proposition. Now, if someone had the skills to deliver those results, what would that be worth paying to get? 80, maybe 90,000 a month? As an outsider, as an interviewee, no less, I added value to his business through the questions that I asked. And all I did was ask business think questions. Now, in the end, they offered me the position. And I kindly turned them down. That only made them crazy. They kept coming back and saying, no, you're the person we want to run the company. You can do this. You have all the skills we need. What they desperately needed was someone who could cut through the confusion, who could cut through the morass and all the information available and make sense of it all to get to the most important issues. Now, the sad story is, a year and a half later, this company was out of business. They didn't have the ability to business think. So in your pursuit of becoming the business person of the now, a better business thinker, the better you get at living the rules, the better your results will be, both personally and professionally. The results can even show up sometimes in places where you least expect it, like a job interview.
I love Dave's story because it shows that business think works personally. It also works for an entire company to live the rules. That's the goal. If there were a business think Hall of Fame, this company, Design Continuum, might be our first nomination to get in. Here's the quick story. Now, one of Design Continuum's clients was Masterlock. If you don't know who they are, you would probably recognize the brand from a commercial that ran years ago during the Super Bowl, which showed a bullet hitting one of those locks and then not breaking it. The commercial conjured up this image of the unbreakable brand. Well, in this case, the bullet still wasn't the problem. The problem was dropping market share. Masterlock's market share, for the first time in decades, had dropped below 50%. So the bullet, so to speak, in this case, was off-brand locks that were being sold at a lower price. Or at least, that appeared to be the problem before they started business thinking. People were still buying padlocks, they just weren't making much of a connection with Masterlock's products. And so the company needed something to revitalize their brand. This is where Design Continuum kind of entered the picture. When they started their work with Masterlock, it would have been easy to just give Masterlock a silver bullet. Some new design, stronger branding, tell them to lower their price, and move on. In fact, that may have been what Masterlock even wanted or expected, but they didn't get that. Design Continuum moved off Masterlock's requested solution to the underlying issues they were trying to solve with the lock itself. After all, a lock is a solution, but what problem is it solving? And keep this in mind, when you're business thinking, when the answer seems like a duh, like locking things up, it takes a real commitment to move off the solution and ask a question that seems obvious. So they moved off the 50-year solution Masterlock had, and they dug for evidence to see what showed up. They went out into the field, watched how real people use padlocks. They were intensely curious. They hung out at department stores and watched how people buy locks. They dug for every piece of evidence they could get their hands on, especially the things that you might not find if you just made some assumptions. And while they were digging for evidence, they found that people don't care about the lock itself, per se. People care about what they're locking up, what they're trying to protect. See, when you dig for evidence, you have to get out of your own head and out of the office or your cubicle. If Design Continuum had just sat in an office and ruminated on the possibilities through their functional expertise or the features and benefits of the lock, they wouldn't have noticed the nuances. What their research found led them to some non-traditional approaches in what they proposed to Masterlock. Based on the evidence and the impact to the consumer, they overhauled the design and packaging of the lock. Based on how they saw people actually using the lock, they changed the shape of the lock, eliminated the rough edges, moved the keyhole from the bottom to the front face, and placed a rubber surface around the lock to actually keep the lock from causing surface scratches to people's important lock-worthy items. It doesn't make much sense if you can keep your stuff safe, keep it from getting stolen, but it's scratching the valuable while it's keeping your stuff safe. They also recommended that the padlocks be placed in different sections of the store where people were buying these things, where people buy non-hardware goods. For example, a home and garden section or a sporting goods section in the store. By making the locks easy to access and relevant to the hobbies or the needs of the customers they were serving that were driving the consumer's need for the lock, they increased the perceived value of Masterlock's brand. They even changed the packaging of the lock to appeal to the hobbies of the customer and the valuables that they want to lock up, and moved away from all of the images of the lock itself, the indestructibility of the lock. In essence, they injected life and functionality into something as cold and lifeless as a steel lock. The cool thing is that they also injected life back into Masterlock. The net result has been the redesign and the reinvention of a company, which is in the lock business, which was an American icon. So no matter what company you work for, the size of the company, no matter what industry you live in every day, no matter if you're in a staff-level position or a line manager or a senior executive, an up-and-coming CEO, or a first-time entrepreneur, the rules work. Being an indispensable business person will no longer be determined solely by how much technical knowledge you have. Although that will still be a factor, you have to be equipped for bigger and better things. In the era of knowledge work, which has been predicted forever and obviously seems to have arrived, your ability to think will be your competitive advantage for you and your company. So how do you get wired for the now of business think? You just practice now. Live it. No excuses. Ease up on yourself when you make a mistake. Live another day. Try again. Nobody's perfect. We weren't. We still aren't. But hopefully that's still the goal. Peter Drucker once said this, "All grand strategies eventually degenerate into work." So take the strategies in business think and then work. Dig in and let that grand degeneration begin. Thanks for listening and the best of luck.
This is the end of the recording. Thank you for listening.